Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is our old friend, Liz Moore, whose fourth novel, Long Bright River, published by Riverhead, is just arriving on our shelves. And I should tell you that Liz will be appearing at our Hilton Garden Inn on January 9th at 7 p.m. The Hilton is right here in Exton, 720 Eagleview Boulevard East. Although I don't know why they call it East, it's just confusing in a typical township move. It's just 15 minutes from Westchester and just past the downtown interchange of the Turnpike across from Eagleview and my bookstore. In fact, we have two hotel buses that can take you from the hotel to the bookshop either before or after the event. Liz knows how to get here since she's been here many times for signings and her writing workshops. You can go to Eventbrite or our website to get tickets. Anyway, as many of you know, this is Liz's fourth novel. The first was The Words of Every Song. Next came Heft, an amazing book that Liz wrote for me kind of out of left field. I had never read anything like it. That was our first interview. She came and signed then and then set up her Palumbo fiction writing workshop here and at other local bookshops, and she still is. Her next novel was The Unseen World, and we visited again with Liz after that, and also a second interview. I know I'm kind of bragging here, but it's been such a pleasure to get to know her and her family and her work. Liz's work has also appeared in Tin House, sadly no longer with us, the New York Times, and she is the winner of many prestigious prizes and awards, and she teaches at Temple. So, Long Bright River is another one of Liz's, I don't know, shape-shifting, genre-busting novels. It's a cop and murderer, psychological thriller, dysfunctional families, anguished accounts of tragic opioid abuse, much of it enumerated in the book's beginning and end. So, I'll leave it there. The difference, as in all of Liz's books, is that there's something here, something that I have a hard time articulating, as I do for all of her books, that is kind of different and you can't put your finger on it, but it kind of changes everything when you read, and I can't say why. So with that semi-articulate introduction, hi Liz, and thanks so much for coming back here and also for driving out to our place this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I am delighted to return to Exton, where I've spent a lot of time at this point, and I'm happy to be talking to you again too.
Thanks. So I guess since we're talking to an audience who knows Philadelphia, how did Kensington in Philly become the jumping off place for this book?
So I am a transplant to Philadelphia. I've lived here a decade, but and my husband's family is all from this area, and he grew up in the area as well. I would say the first arc of this book came actually during my first year of living in Philadelphia. In 2009, I moved here, and a friend of mine is the photographer Jeffrey Stockbridge, who's been making kind of an amazing series on Kensington called Kensington Blues, which is also the name of his website if you're interested in seeing some of his images. And he has been making portraits of the residents of Kensington for a very long time. And he invited me to go up with him because he was interested in having a writer's perspective on it. So I went up with him a handful of times that first year to interview some of his subjects. And I found their stories really, really troubling and compelling. And I hadn't heard a lot about the opioid crisis prior to that. And I think most that would be true for most people who were living in the country in 2009. The opioid crisis was fully underway, but there wasn't nearly as much publicity around it as there is today. And so I found it so, I was so incredulous at what was going on sort of out in the open that I began going back to the neighborhood on my own and ended up doing some community work there, teaching writing workshops at a women's day shelter, writing some nonfiction. And eventually I began writing the sketches of a short story that would become the basis of Long Bright River, although I never ended up publishing that short story. So that's kind of the origin story of the novel. And of course, the writing process itself was is a different story, but that's it.
Well, so, you know, from our last interviews that I, and you do this, I really like epigraphs, and you have two here, and I always like them generally because they kind of seem thematic from the author's mind. So you have two, one, which is the description of Kensington and a city within a city. And then you have, and they're really long. And then you have Tennyson's Lotus Eaters, which other than the relationship to opium, it's interesting that you did those. And why did you choose to do two? And why did you choose to take the risk of making them so long?
So great questions. I think so hard about my epigraphs. The one from the primary source document, Kensington, A City Within a City, which as far as I can tell was written as a sort of like early PR document about Kensington, I found in a book I was using for research called White Town USA about the decline of working class white neighborhoods in the United States. And the author of that book included that excerpt just as sort of an example of how devastating the collapse of manufacturing has been in the United States to neighborhoods like Kensington. He was using it as contrast. And of course, I found it appealing as well, kind of for the same reason. And then the Tennyson quote came out of a long search for a title for this book. I was completely befuddled by what to call it for most of my writing process. The title came very, very late to me. And so I just started looking back through anything I could find, like artistic, I guess I should say written, let's say texts about all a huge variety of things, addiction, family, specifically heroin or opium derived medicines. And I found this Tennyson poem. I don't actually love Tennyson as a poet, but I loved the phrase Long Bright River. And I thought it was kind of a compelling description of what it feels like to be under the spell of a narcotic. And I was able to use that phrase a couple, I think in three different ways throughout the rest of the book. So the Tennyson epigraph kind of snuck its way in mostly as a vehicle for the title of the book.
Yeah, and it's like it really kind of lulls you into this interesting mood, kind of like, I don't know, this kind of sleepy, nebulous mood before you begin the book. So it kind of gets you ready for the book in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think it's pretty, when you really think about what it feels like to be under the spell of a narcotic, everything becomes more understandable, I think.
Hey, this is a question that, I don't know, it probably isn't something you think about, but now that I've read all four books, and we talked about when we had that dinner together, okay, so you switch genres all the time, and, you know, the first being about a musician, the second being about a more morbidly obese guy, the third being about an AI, and then this fourth one being, this psychological kind of Dashiell Hammett kind of Agatha Christie kind of work. Do you notice at all in retrospect if there's any particular threads that run through all four of these books?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
Believe it.
You do?
I think you're right that I'm constantly like playing with genre and reinventing my style is pretty consistent and my voice is pretty consistent across my books, but certainly the subject matter changes wildly. But some themes that I think I write about over and over again, even in a way that makes me self-conscious, are like the search for family or finding a created family. I write a lot about that, like in at least Heft and The Unseen World and Long Bright River. I feel like I'm pointing out all the things that I'm ashamed of like duplicating in my work, but I write a lot about characters who create families of friends or of adult figures because their own families were sort of like dysfunctional in some way. So that pops up a lot. And to be honest, addiction has popped up in both Heft and this book. Heft was addiction to alcohol. But in this book, it's addiction to opioids. But the theme of addiction has come up on multiple occasions as well.
You know, when I'm thinking about all four books also, I think I told you last time about, you know, people that like books that end in a way that they have to think about what happened and what's going to happen, and other people end books in a way that everything's kind of tied up. And you chose a particular method in this book, which I won't say, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering why you chose to end it somewhat differently than your other books in this particular way.
It's funny because I could probably describe the ending in either way. Like, I can see how somebody might think the ending is like sort of tied up more tightly in this book, because certainly there's like an answer to one of the big puzzles of the book in this book. But also, I think a lot of questions are raised about what's going to happen to all of these characters next in the very end of the book. So, you know, I too don't want to give anything away, but there's probably an open-endedness to the book in that sense as well. I guess with the first approach, it felt strange to me to borrow heavily from the conventions of a police procedural without kind of like driving it home at the end. And like, it's almost like you have an obligation to the reader if you've enticed them with like many twists and turns and plot devices to see them through at the end and to not leave them hanging. Then again, there's a lot of genre bending stuff that hasn't done that. I'm thinking obviously of like True Detective, which was so polarizing to a lot of people. I loved the ending of True Detective, but so many people were mad about it. I'm talking about the first season of True Detective.
The
best one, except I think the ending was very, very polarizing because a lot of people didn't feel like it either felt like it came out of left field or it didn't feel sufficiently resolved. I liked it. I don't know. I think my book is more resolved than that was, but I think I also tried to leave some questions to the reader to answer.
I was kind of worried at the end. Like, did you ever see that movie Kramer versus Kramer with Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep?
A long time ago, yeah.
That's what I was kind of worried about. Maybe maybe something coming back, but again, I won't give anything away. And it's kind of tough to ask questions about this one because there are so many possible spoilers. Well, go ahead and, you know, I always do this, but just give a synopsis like you did at the dinner of the book itself. You know, like I said, it's cops and murderers and opioid, but just give a little bit of talk about who the cops are and how they develop relationships and especially her partner.
Sure. So do you want like a synopsis of the whole book or just specifically the cop element?
Yeah, no, just what you usually do, what you usually have
to
do.
So this is the story of two sisters who grow up together in the neighborhood of Kensington and Philip. Actually, they grew up in Fishtown, an adjacent neighborhood. And they're raised by their grandmother because their parents themselves have succumbed to opioid addiction. So the demise of their parents splits the sisters pretty profoundly in terms of life path. One sister becomes completely straight and narrow and is kind of obsessed with the perception of herself as completely on the straight and narrow. And she joins the Philadelphia Police Department as a patrol officer. That's the older sister, Mickey. And the younger sister goes in the opposite direction and sort of follows in her parents' footsteps, developing an addiction to first prescription pills and then heroin, and ends up living kind of on and off the streets in Kensington, doing sex work to support her addiction. And she, Casey, goes missing at the start of the novel, right around the time that a series of women who fit her same demographic profile are also being murdered. So the two sisters have been estranged for a while at the start of the novel, but when Mickey discovers that her sister's missing at the same time that this string of murders is happening, their kind of shared closeness as children compels her to go looking for her sister first on the job. But then when she decides that she needs to go even further, she starts sort of searching for her off the job in a way that gets her into trouble with the police force and causes her to break a lot of the rules of the police force for the first time. And I guess I'll just go further and say one more thing, which is that she begins to question kind of like the police force itself as an organization over the course of the book. And that's kind of a big theme in the novel too.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, again, going back to mysteries that we've all read over the course of our lives, is that there's a lot of kind of red herring, MacGuffin kind of things in here that you must have followed them down some dark alleys yourself before you decided which way you were going to go, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that the thing that is important to me every time I write a book is not to operate in binaries and to give everybody enough backstory that they're kind of plausible as a human. I mean, some people I think might just be truly evil, and there might be a couple of those in this book too, but for the most part, you know, characters who think of themselves as good and right and just and on the right side of the law and of morality maybe aren't, and vice versa. You know, characters who operate outside the bounds of the law and who perceive themselves to be bad in some ways also sometimes are not that completely or at all. So I was interested in that as a philosophical question and also as kind of a writing device, because that's helpful to a writer when you're writing a very kind of like plotty book in a way that this is. It's helpful to be able to like reverse expectations in the reader's mind, which happens a couple of times, I think.
Yeah, once with her, and again, keeping away from giving it away, you know, her ex-partner, who she really admires, her feelings toward him change and then change and then change. And then with her sister's boyfriend, I'm thinking one thing, and I'm thinking it unilaterally, like this is the way he is. And all of a sudden I realize, no, he's not. And you kind of change right. you change your viewpoint of him perfectly. I mean, it's like he becomes I can't say anymore.
I think that's probably, as I said, it is a useful plot device, but also I think that's kind of how reality is in a lot of ways. When we think about the criminal justice system and who's guilty and who's not guilty and who's to blame and who's not to blame, there are a lot of moving parts when you start to get into those questions, especially when it comes to addiction. You know, I have little kids and I'm constantly finding myself like, kids are very binary thinkers at first, and they think in terms of like good guys and bad guys. And part of that is the media they consume, like Disney movies have good guys and bad guys and stuff like that. And so my daughter will be like obsessed with the idea of robbers and like robbers are bad and are there robbers and who are robbers and things like that. And I have to try very hard not to like start talking to her about like Jean Valjean, like, but what would you do if you didn't have a loaf of bread? Or, you know, like I do raise those questions with her, but I guess I kind of take that to an extreme when I have this expansiveness that a novel affords me in terms of like raising questions of what is actually moral and what society, the laws of society versus the laws of morality, which sometimes are at odds with each other.
Yeah. And I guess when I go back to the introduction, I guess the reason why I think that your books are somewhat different, even though the genre is specific, you know, it's like, yeah, you're right about changing perceptions. And then you talk about the police and all that. But it's true of your friends. It's true of your business partners. It's sometimes for some parents, true of their kids.
Yeah, right. That's very true.
Mm-hmm. And you don't, you know, then afterwards you go, why didn't I see that? Or, I never expected this to happen, or my life has totally changed, or all kinds of things. Or even after people die, and you change your feeling completely about that too.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
So, you know, go back to what I was saying about it, because it is to me so cinematic. Mm-hmm. And so when you were writing it, did you see it in your head as if it was, not, I don't mean silly things mm-hmm. like as a TV series or anything like that, but did you see it unfolding like as if you were watching a movie?
Well, I always try to build place carefully in a way that is understandable to readers so that they can feel fully immersed in a text that I write. So I certainly, like, there's that visual aspect of it. They have to be able to understand what they're looking at and where they are before they can feel situated in the story. I don't think I was writing intentionally cinematically. I do think I've been influenced as much by detective films and television as I have by detective literature. So maybe some of the style of TV and movies has kind of made its way into my writing, as well as books that I've read. So maybe that's what you're noticing or picking up on.
Yeah, well, also in my head, it was really easy to form a picture of what these people looked like. Maybe not mm-hmm. what you envisioned at all, but I mean, Thomas and Mickey, I really had an idea of what they looked like, but I couldn't describe it to you.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to, because maybe one day it will be a TV series or a movie, and then we'll have to cast it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I kind of thought of Mickey as having like short, blondish, kind of sandy hair, and I don't know why I thought she had bangs.
That is interesting. Yeah, that's not how I picture her, but that's a good thing,
no,
I guess.
No, yeah. I don't. How do you picture her?
Well, she has to have enough hair for a short ponytail, which she's described as having from time to time. And I guess I always pictured her as having brown hair, just because I associate completely stereotypically brown hair is like more serious somehow. And she's a very serious person. Now, I have been both blonde and brown haired in my life. So I realize that that's like kind of a bogus theory, but you know, operating in terms of how society perceives us. That's how I perceive her.
What do you think about like people who are going to say to you in book clubs, not book clubs, but in signings and readings about, why didn't she pay more attention to Thomas? Why didn't she pay more attention to her son? Why did she leave him? That kind of thing. Cause that'll come up.
Yeah. So I think I've dealt with a lot of questions over the years about like questions of likability about my characters, because a lot of people have real opinions or like take certain characters to task or really are angry with them. And I guess I'll say two things in response. And one is like, that's okay. You know, like it's okay for you to not like how this person acts in certain situations. Like that's a valid reaction. I too felt bad for Thomas in a lot of ways as I was writing it. But I think the second response is like, there are a lot of single mothers, single parents without many financial resources who constantly find themselves in the position of having to do things that they don't want to do at the expense of the well-being of their children even. And that's something that we don't like to think about because it's not comfortable, but it's a fact. And, you know, I am a person with resources and children, and I still have to constantly navigate questions of childcare because I work and my partner works. So it's a reality in my life, which means that it's a truly horrendous reality in the life of somebody with fewer resources.
Okay. Well, lastly, I guess, And going along with what you're just talking about and what we're talking about with like True Detective and all that, why do you think that people are so fascinated with murder? The opioid crisis, yes, I understand completely. But why do you think that throughout most literature that they're so fascinated with the concept of murder and tracking down the murderer? Because you must have thought about that too.
Yeah. Well, it feels like both true crime and detective fiction are having a moment, and TV and movies right now. But you're right that it is an ongoing, like they've never really faded from popularity. A very facile answer is that people like to feel like they have some control over what terrifies us the most, and so reading about what terrifies us the most is a safe way to experiment with that. Same reason people go see horror movies or go on roller coasters or go into haunted houses at Halloween. You know, you want to kind of like walk on the edge of an experience that you hope to never have, maybe. I guess as for like why there's a zeitgeisty thing happening with true crime and detective and procedurals right now, I don't know. I feel like the world is a little bit out of control and we're living in dark times. Yeah. And then again, they do crop up. I mean, I was lucky enough to have three grandparents who all lived into their 90s or close to their 90s, who all died in the past, let's say 5 years. All three of them died. But so I knew them well into my adulthood, and it was nice to have them around, because for however dark I felt our times were, they were there to sort of be like, but also World War II happened in our lifetime. Yeah. And the Holocaust did, and you know, Jim Crow happened during our lifetimes, and you know, there are ups and downs in history, and it's almost narcissistic to think we're living in like the most down time. Like certain things have gotten a lot better and certain things have gotten a lot worse. So I don't know.
Is my mom, who died in June, mm-hmm. she was 96. Mm-hmm. She said to me, the worst thing that has ever happened to me in my life is Donald Trump.
That's and amazing.
I said, Mom, what about, you know, the Depression and World War II and Vietnam and Korea and Stalin and all that? She goes, nope. The worst thing.
Yeah. There's that perspective too.
And yeah. Then I met one of your grandparents, and he was like the coolest guy in the world.
Yeah, he was a cool dude. He took a workshop at your bookstore, which is a very special memory for me. Yeah, it was cool.
All right. With that, Liz, so we've been talking to you about your latest novel, Long Bright River, and I don't know, what's next? Historical fiction?
No, definitely not. But whatever it is, it's too early for me to talk about. Okay. I am working on something, but I have to keep it under wraps for now.
I'll ask you when I see you.
Okay.
Good. Thanks as always. Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you. I do too.
So we were talking with Liz Moore about her new book, Long Bright River, and Liz will be appearing at the Wellington Square Bookshop, just off the Downingtown Interchange of the Turnpike and across from the Hilton Garden Inn, which she may be appearing at depending on how many people we get, and we're doing pretty well now. So in any event, Long Bright River is a great book. It's a genre shift for her. She started out with this book about this morbidly obese guy, another one about a musician, another one about an AI, artificial intelligence, and this last one is a regular psychological cop thriller, which I think has already been picked up and optioned for a series on Netflix or something like that. So as always, join us every week. Liz, that was her third time here. Upcoming authors include Karine Jean Pierre, who will discuss her insightful memoir, Moving Forward, A Story of Hope, Hard Work, and the Promise of America. For a complete schedule, you can always visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, or you can go to Podomatic or to the iTunes podcast application. Anyway, thanks a lot for joining us today, and hope you'll be back next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.